To begin this morning, I'd like to read from 2 Peter, the second chapter, verses 4 through 10. You want to turn there and follow along. 2 Peter, chapter 2, verses 4 through 10. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to deliver the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. Last week we were in the first three verses of this chapter, where Peter is warning about false teachers. There were false prophets in Israel in olden times. There are going to be false teachers in the Lord's church in modern times. And as we talked about last week, a false teacher is not a mistaken teacher. Now, I'm wrong on many things, and you are also, but not because we're trying to be wrong. We're wrong for various reasons, some of them very human in their origin. But a false teacher is not simply a mistaken teacher. A false teacher is somebody who's on the other side. A false teacher is someone who's an enemy of the cross of Christ. A false teacher, like John talks about, are those who are not of us. They have an ulterior motive that has nothing to do with the salvation found in Christ. You know, referees and umpires, they make mistakes all the time, but nobody ever accuses them of being a false referee or a false umpire. But there are exceptions to that. Some time back, I watched a documentary about a referee in the NBA. I cannot remember his name. This happened some time ago. But he got embroiled with some bad people, and he started accepting money to throw games, to make a game turn out a certain way. He was not committed to calling a game as he saw it. He was not committed to fairness, to equity. He was going to make calls that would give one of the two teams a better chance of winning. And when he was caught, he was gone. I can't remember if he went to jail. He was certainly thrown out of the NBA and banned for life. He was a false referee. I was watching the game yesterday, and there were calls made I didn't agree with. But they were honest mistakes. A false teacher is not someone who simply makes honest mistakes. A false teacher is someone who has a God other than Jesus Christ. And Peter tips us off to who that God is in verse 3 when he introduces the word covetousness. More often than not, if you want to know what's going on, if you want to know the explanation to why things are as they are, and I believe Peter endorses this, he says, follow the money. Paul says, the love of money is the root of all evil. That explains most of the inexplicable things going on in our society today. That explains most of the votes that are cast in Congress. Follow the money. And so it is with false teachers. They are trying to enrich themselves, increase their power, their prestige, whatever, in underhanded, devious ways. And so, we talked about that last week. When a false teacher gets into the church, that church is in terrible shape. And Peter doesn't want that to happen. And so, having introduced false teachers, he's going to reassure us in verse 4 through 10. Verses 4 through 10 are a reassurance that God is in control. I mean, we look at this world around us and we think, God, where are you? Prophets thought that. Habakkuk wants to know, Lord, It's a mess here. Where are you? Why aren't you doing something? And there are passages where we are reminded and reassured that God is doing something. He's in control. He knows exactly what's going on. And that's what Peter does in verses 4 through 10. In regard to false teachers, God is in control. And let me give you the structure of verses 4 through 10. And this will be the two parts of our outline this morning in this study. What Peter does here is the oldest form of deductive argument. The if-then argument. If this is so, if this is so, then this is so. And so what Peter says in verse 4, if what God did with the angels... Verse 5, if what God did with the ancient world. Verse 6, if what God did with Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 7, if what God did with Lot is so, then, verse 9, don't worry. If God has demonstrated that He knows how to deal with the wicked and the righteous, if God has demonstrated He knows how to deliver the righteous while at the same time destroying the wicked, don't worry, He's in control. He will take care of things. And so that's the two points of the outline. If angels, if the world, if Sodom and Gomorrah, if Lot, then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment until the day of judgment. That's the argument. And what I want to do in trying to unpack everything that Peter says in this passage is to go back to verse 5, and we'll take up each of the if premises, each of the conditional statements before we get to the conclusion there in verse 9. So let's first off talk about the angels. I'll read the verse again. If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. Now, just about every time I have taught on this passage and get to this verse, there's someone in the audience who has just read a book about angels and they know everything there is to know about angels. And they're happy to explain everything that Peter's talking about here involving the angels. And Peter's talking about angels who sinned. And he's talking about angels who were kicked out of heaven. And he's talking about angels who are now on death row. They are being reserved for the day of judgment, and there's no bail, there's no bond, there's no reprieve for them. That's who Peter's talking about. Some people think that they know everything about what's going on here. And often when you go to the commentaries to read what commentators have to say about verse 4, for some reason, they want to go back to Genesis chapter 6. Now, I'm just telling you what you'll find if you consult commentaries. And here's what many of them, if not most of them, say. Genesis 6 verse 2 talks about how the sons of God saw the daughters of men and took them for wives. And many of the commentators will say that the sons of God there are the angels. Now, it's true that in the Bible, angels are referred to as the sons of God. Read the first chapter of Job to see that. It's also true we're referred to as the sons of God, the children of God. But for some reason, commentators like to go back to an obscure verse in Genesis, and they try to tell you that the sons of God there are angels. Well, how do they know that? In Genesis 6, 2, sons of God marry the children of men, but I read in the Bible where angels don't marry, they're not given in marriage, but yet a lot of people think that back in Genesis 6, 2, the angels of the sons of God are angels who married women, and that's what got them kicked out of heaven. They're consorting with women. And they take that obscure verse in Genesis and they use that to explain the obscure verse in 2 Peter 2:4, and they say, now it all ought to be crystal clear. Well, it's not clear to me at all what they're saying. And let me remind you of some things. When you come across a verse like 2 Peter 2:4, talking about angels that sin and being thrown out of heaven, when you come across a verse like that, it's kind of like eating fish. Now, when I was a kid, we did not have the kind of fish then that we have now. The fish we have now never has any bones in it. Have you noticed that? When you go to Red Lobster, you go to Long John Silver, you order fish, you go to the kettle here and you order fish, you're not going to get any fish with any bones in it. But when I was a kid, the fish we had were the fish we caught out of the Sangamon or out of the Middle Fork, and those catfish had bones everywhere. And I've seen my grandfather sit at the table eating a piece of catfish, and he gets a bone stuck in his throat. And the tears are just coming down his face, you know. And you know what he did to debone himself? He'd get a big wad of white bread. He'd kind of choke that down, and that wad of bread would clean out all the bones. And he'd be fine. We don't have to do that anymore. When you're studying the Bible and you come to a passage that's got a bone in it, do what we used to do back then when eating. If we came to a piece of fish that had a bone, we'd take the bone out and lay it on the plate and go on eating the fish. And when you come in the Bible to something, you're really not sure quite what it's talking about, just lay it aside and go on and eat what you can eat. Because remember, the main things are the plain things. And let me tell you what's the plain thing to me in verse 4. The plain thing is that not even angels are exempt from judgment. God does not play favorites. They were not too big to fail. Doesn't matter what exalted position angels hold in God's hierarchy. They sinned. Somehow or other, they rebelled. And they suffered the consequences for it. That's the first condition that Peter posits. God dealt with sinning angels. He dealt with rebellious angels. All right, the second condition there in verse 5. He did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of 8 people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. We go from angels now, obviously, to men, the world at the time of Noah. Now, Hebrews 11:7 talks about what Peter's talking about here. And Hebrews 11:7 says, by faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. Noah was told by God to do something. Peter tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. And we believe that, but I'll guarantee you the people of Noah's time, his neighbors did not primarily think of him as being a preacher of righteousness. You know how they probably thought of him? Not as a preacher, but as a psychotic. You know what a psychotic is? It's someone who's lost touch with reality. What would you think about a neighbor building a 450-foot long boat in his backyard? Have any of you been to the Ark there in Kentucky? You know, they built that full scale. I mean, that is just something else. I was there a few years ago. Out in the middle of, it's just out in the middle of a field. Now, I know why they built it. They built that ark to get my money in their pocket. That's why they built it. And I was happy to give it to them, you know. But no one's ever seen a flood like would require the kind of boat that Noah's building, and he's out there building that. They all, I can guarantee you, thought he was a nutcase. But he was a preacher of righteousness, and even by building that boat, he was preaching. Noah lived in a time, now I've talked about Genesis 6:2, the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. And by the way, I'll tell you this. I believe the sons of God were the descendants of Seth, the third boy born to Adam and Eve, and the sons of men were the descendants of Cain. And those two families, one that tended toward the good, the other that tended toward the evil, they married, they intermarried, and there's bad consequences. But in Genesis 6:5, three verses after 6:2, Genesis 6:5 says that every intent of the thought of man's heart was only evil continually. And don't miss the adverbs. Every, only, continually. That's how bad it had gotten in the world. Every thought in their heart was only, no exceptions, evil continually, 24/7. That's where the world got to. And what this verse tells us is that man can go so low, and we'll see that in the next verse, man can go so low that God says, you're beyond help. This past Wednesday night in our class on Micah, one of the things God says about Israel is that their condition was incurable. The nation of Israel in the time of Micah got to the point where there was nothing more God could do than what He had already done to try to say. They're incurable. In the last chapter of 2 Kings, God sent His prophets to His people, trying to get them to repent and turn back. And He sent His prophets until, the text says, there was no remedy. God had given them every medicine He knew to give them. And none of them worked. There was no remedy. They were incurable. And that was the world of Noah's day. And what did God do? He brought in a flood. The Greek word translated flood here is the word cataclysm. He caused a catastrophic, a worldwide disaster. God knew what to do about the world of Noah's day, but it was not everybody who was caught, was it? Because Noah and his family, there were eight of them. They were saved. Noah prepared an ark to the saving of his house. God did not throw the baby out with the bathwater. God recognized who was walking by faith and who was righteous, and He delivered them. That ark that Noah was building was the means of God's deliverance. Not just for Noah. Anybody could have gotten on that ark. But only eight people got on. They were not caught in the destruction. They were destroyed. So, if God knows how to deal with angels, if God knows how to deal with the entire world, if God knows how to deal with the worst city on earth, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and for simplification, I'm just going to talk about Sodom. But everything I say about Sodom applies to the other cities of the plain. In Genesis chapter 19, we learn that the city of Sodom was totally given over to perversity. And that's pretty much the way it's getting in our country. Sodom was completely perverse, immoral, engaging in the unnatural, the unspeakable. And that's pretty much the way it's gotten to in many places in this country. And folks, simply legalizing perversity does not civilize it, does not glamorize it, does not change how God looks at it. Everything that God says is disgusting and corrupt and perverse. We say, no, it's legal. It's okay for anybody who wants to do it. And that was Sodom. And again, God says, Romans chapter 1, when men go that low, I give up. Romans chapter 1, three times says, God gave them over. He let them have at it. until finally he said, I just can't take this anymore, and I'm going to destroy Sodom. And Peter says that God reduced Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes. Now, you remember, if you read the bulletin, in the past few weeks I was talking about people who are looking for the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. There are archaeologists who periodically go over to the Dead Sea and look for Sodom and Gomorrah. And some of them think they found it. Get you those bulletins and read them. Some of them think they found Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't think they have. According to Peter, God cremated. He didn't bury them. He cremated them. He reduced them to ashes. Now, if you have a house that completely burns down and there's nothing left but a pile of ashes, 3,000, 4,000 years later, what are your chances of finding any of the ashes? Now, maybe you can find the footing down there. Maybe that's possible. I don't know. But God reduced those cities to ashes. And look at the word in verse 6, translated destruction. The word flood in verse 5 is the word cataclysm. The Greek word translated destruction in verse 6 is the word catastrophe. God does not hesitate to resort to cataclysms and catastrophes in dealing with the wicked. And then the fourth if, verse 7. If God knew what to do with the angels, if He knew what to do with the world, if He knew what to do with Sodom, if God knew what to do with Lot. Let's read verse 7 again. God delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Quick review of the life of Lot from Genesis. Genesis chapter 13, there is a quarrel between the shepherds that Lot hired to oversee his flock and the shepherds that Abraham hired. And Abraham gets everybody together and says, listen, we're family. We're brethren. We're not going to have this quarrel going on here. So Lot, I tell you what, you pick where you want to pasture your flocks, anywhere you pick is fine with me. I'll take an area you don't pick. That's where I'll take my sheep. And so Lot liked that, and he looks around, he surveys everything. And when he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, at that point in time, Sodom and Gomorrah was so green and so fertile and so lush that it reminded people of the stories they had heard about the Garden of Eden. Now, if you don't believe me, go back and read Genesis 13:10. Because that's the verse I just referred to. Now, that's not the way it looks today. I mean, having been there last year, that is the deadest place on earth, around the Dead Sea. But not back then. And so, Genesis 13 says, Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. He moved everybody down in the direction of Sodom. When we turn to Genesis 14, verse 1, the text says, Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. Now that's an idiom. And you can get a concordance and trace it through the Bible. To sit in the gate essentially means to be on the village board, to be one of the town judges. Genesis 13, he moves near Sodom. Genesis 14, he's living in Sodom. And then in Genesis 19, he is entrenched in Sodom. Moved near, moved in, sucked in. Lot's story is he moved near, then he moved in, and then he was sucked in. He was so sucked in to Sodom, its way of thinking, its way of living, its way of doing, that when the angels went and told him, you need to get out of Dodge because God's going to destroy this town, he couldn't do it. He could not bring himself to do it. And the angels literally drug him out of town, led him out of town. And yet the first thing that Peter tells us, he tells us twice, is that Lot was a righteous man. I doubt that we would look upon him that way. Because here's what he did. He picked the worst town on the face of the earth to move his family to. And if we knew a Christian had moved his family to a cesspool of a society, to a hellhole morally, what would we think about their spirituality or their commitment to God? Well, we'd probably have some serious doubts about it. But Lot could not have picked a worse town to move his family to. But that's what he did. And there are three things to note about Lot there in Sodom. He was saved, he was sickened, and he was stressed. Despite the fact he's living in Sodom, he's a righteous man. He's a forgiven, he's a saved man. But I'll tell you this, folks. There are some places where it's easier to be saved than others. Now, there are righteous Christians in California, but I'm not moving to California. I mean, there are some professions. It's tougher to be a Christian in that profession. It's tougher to hold on to your Christian convictions in that profession than in others. It's really tough being a public school teacher, being a Christian and being a public school teacher these days, because the pressure that is going to be put on you by your co-workers, your colleagues, by the union, by the administration, to conform and buckle under and kneel down to the gods of this world are going to be so intense. It's really tough to be a godly school teacher. Now, there are godly school teachers and godly administrators like Henry's dad. But it's tough. And so, yeah, Lot lived in Sodom. He was a saved man. But he was sickened by it. His righteous soul was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. And that word translated oppressed, the King James uses the word vexed, is a word in the Greek that means he was just ground down by being in Sodom. Sodom never let up. Sodom doubled down on him and just kept hitting him and hitting him. And he looks around and sees all the perversity, and he was sickened by it. Saved, but sickened. And then number three, he was stressed. Now I want you to look at this. Verse 8. For that righteous man, talking about for Lot dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day. That doesn't say Sodom tormented his righteous soul. It says he, Lot, tormented his righteous soul. What that tells me is that Lot had a bunch of misgivings. He was having all kinds of second thoughts, second doubts about whether he'd made the right choice or not. And he had no peace because of the questions he had about his own decisions, his own choices that he had made. When I was in Nashville, I cannot remember this man's name. He was a member of the church there where I was at in Nashville. And periodically he would come to me just overwhelmed by guilt in his life. And we'd talk, and I couldn't tell that he was doing anything to have this kind of guilt. And we would read passages like Psalm 103 that reassure us of God's forgiveness. But every once in a while he'd show up. And then one day he kind of opened up. And what I learned is that he wasn't sure he should be married. He had a wife. She never came with him. And he didn't go into any detail. But he was not certain. He had all kinds of doubts whether or not that he as a Christian should be in the marriage that he was in. And he was tormented constantly by that thought. And I think that's where Lot was. this godly man, this righteous man, who had made all kinds of bad decisions. How can the Bible talk about Lot having made all the bad decisions he made as being righteous? I'll tell you how. By grace. He wasn't righteous because he made wise decisions. He was righteous by the grace of God. He was a true believer. He had not become a pagan in his thinking about God. He was an exception to the rule. But he was conflicted. He was stressed. And he paid a price. His original decision to move near Sodom was a business decision. He had all kinds of flocks, herds. Go to where the pasture is. Go to where it's green. It was a business decision. And then he gets close, and then he decides, you know, it'd be better if I was right in town. So at some point he moves into town. Then he runs for the village board, gets elected. He's got some influence in town. But because of the decision he made, he lost all of his business. He had lost his peace of mind. He lost his home. He lost his family. He got out of town with two daughters. He lost everybody else. Now, Christians can be Christians and make terrible mistakes, and there are consequences that they will suffer for the mistakes they've made. That was Lot. But if God knows how to deal with the angels and the world and Sodom and Lot, verse 9, rest assured, He knows how to get us out of temptations even... Now listen, He knows how to get us out of temptations even if it takes a cataclysm and a catastrophe to do so. God used a catastrophe to deliver Noah. God used a catastrophe, the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, to deliver Lot. If we get ourselves in a mess and we pray, Father, lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil, God's going to say, all right, I'll do it, but buckle your seatbelt, because it may take a catastrophe or a cataclysm for me to get you out of the mess that you're in. So what are the big lessons here? Well, judgment is inevitable, but it is not inescapable. Noah escaped it by faith. Lot, for all the mess he made of his life and his family, he escaped it. Judgment is inevitable, but not unescapable. Unrighteousness will be condemned. God knows what's going on, and He's sovereign. And in the words of Martin Luther, and though this world with demons filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed His truth to triumph through us. Our Lord knows how to deliver the righteous and how to deal with the ungodly.